They go into those firms, they apply the administrative method, and they kill the golden goose because innovation stops and administration takes over.
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
All right, welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. Today I've got my friend Hunter Hastings with us. Hunter is an author, economist, venture capitalist, passionate entrepreneur, released a new book, Venture Mode. Let's see if you're watching. Got it right here. Venture Mode. He co-authored it with Mark Packard. And it's subtitled Escape the Administration Trap by Finding and Unleashing Entrepreneurial Leaders. It's published by, is it Amplify, May 5th, 2026, if I recall, Hunter, correct?
Yeah, Amplify Publishing.
All right. Welcome, Hunter.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. So, like I said, Hunter's a friend, and we talk most every week. But this is the first time on the podcast.
Right.
And I've been itching to get him on, and he's just got a new book. So, and he's got more books for you all to read and more coming out. So, we talk about Venture Mode here, Hunter, in the book, or you do, and you mm-hmm. and Mark. Tell us a little about what you mean by Venture Mode.
Well, let's start on the negative side, administration mode, because that's what we're escaping from. And administration mode is the increasing application of the machinery of corporate control in business. And control is the key word. So as businesses get successful and get big, they got that way through entrepreneurship and innovation and doing something different and better. They move into administration mode when they start to get more concerned about controlling the uncertainty of the future and less concerned with innovation and the kind of risky undertakings that entrepreneurs like to do. And so they start to exercise control. And the financial markets exercise control too. You've got to have smooth quarterly earnings. You've got to make your numbers. You've got to hit your expectations. Those are all control mechanisms, and they do that by adding administration, more layers of decision-making, installed processes that must be followed, installed calendars, annual planning cycles, those kinds of things. And it's a real crisis at the moment, Ryan. We talk in the book about how we may have lost half, 50% of the productivity growth potential in the U.S. economy. That's thousands of dollars per year in every family's pocket. So it's a serious crisis. It's potentially a national security crisis. If we don't keep up with China, then that's a national security problem. There's a book by Dan Wang who talks about the China problem with they innovate, we administer. He calls it we litigate, but it's the same thing. So venture mode is the opposite of that. It's this discovery that we've got to eliminate these layers of control and inject more freedom. And the beginnings of the idea from Mark and I, there's a lot of study in the book. Mark's a professor at Florida Atlantic University, so he researches these things deeply, and he's one of the leaders in entrepreneurial theory thinking. But it comes from Silicon Valley. Brian Chesky was the founder of Airbnb, a fabulously successful corporation. It started with a pure experiment. They were inviting people to stay in Brian's home, Brian and a couple of buddies, and sleep on an airbed when hotel rooms were scarce in San Francisco for a developer conference. And it kind of worked, and he expanded the idea, and it was a pure entrepreneurial play. There was no planning. There was no budgeting. There was no administration. But eventually Airbnb got big, and it started to require those administrative tools. And they arrived in the form of management layers. And Brian found there were more management layers between him and the customer. And he couldn't see that. He couldn't see the details. He couldn't see what was going right. He couldn't see what was going wrong because of these management layers. And so he decided that he's going to cut all that out and get back into what he called in the details. He went and stayed with Airbnb hosts. He talked to consumers, and he was in the details of what works and what doesn't. He made a speech about that at a Y Combinator conference, and the founder of Y Combinator, Paul Graham, publicized it, and that became known as founder mode. And the essence of founder mode is they told us when we got big, we had to have MBAs and professional managers running our businesses. And that turned out to be the opposite of the truth. It destroyed our businesses. So then Mark and I expanded that idea to venture mode, which is that anybody can do that, not just a founder, but any corporation can rediscover this non-administrative, entrepreneurial, free-thinking, innovative way of running a business.
Right. And in a lot of ways, the administration comes from the MBA, the Masters of Business Administration. And you talk a little bit about the administration trap and how we, in MBAs are business leaders, generally speaking, within the culture or the world, really. But you talk about the administration trap. And so how did this class of folks, the administrative class, how did they convince everyone that that's what they need? You're trying to reimagine that. So, but how did this come up in the first place?
So let me try to tell a long story in a really short time, Brian. So we trace this progress in the book. So it starts in the universities with a movement called logical positivism that says that everything has to be measured. The only proof is measurement, the scientific method, and so on. Those European professors came to America, and some of them landed up in business schools.
What time frame are we talking about, Hunter?
We're talking about the mid-20th century here, mid to late 20th century. And so they said the scientific method can be applied to business. So the same analytical, numerical, non-human kind of way of approaching science could be applied to business. And that became the MBA. And that became a product of the most administrative, bureaucratic kind of organization in the world, which is the US university. And so that became a prestigious degree to have because you could get a better job. It attracted all these people. They go into those firms, they apply the administrative method, and they kill the golden goose because innovation stops and administration takes over. So it all started with an intellectual movement in the universities, applied in the business school, then it migrated into business, and that's where the sclerosis took place.
And do you think at the beginning, this is what I wonder about, you know, talking with you and reading the book, I don't know that it's nefarious. It just happens to be not necessarily what you believe we need. But did the MBA or the Masters of Business Administration, did it start out that way? Because, or did we not just not have the skills or the literature or anything to figure this out, that there could be another way, and this became the dominant way of thinking, and then there was no room to think otherwise? Is that a good analysis or not?
I think it may be nefarious, but more important, it's elitist. We know better than you do. And one of the famous origin stories is Frederick Taylor's scientific management textbook, where everything is measured. They measured the productivity of the individual worker by the number of shovelfuls of coal that they could produce in a minute. And that became the standard. Then everybody has to be controlled to hit that norm of number of shovelfuls of coal per minute. That becomes the control mechanism. And that's because, as Taylor said, the human being can't be the focus. The system has to be the focus. We got to figure out these averages, then apply the averages, and then elevate the averages. It's all system, 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 control, 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 and the humanity is taken out of it. Now, you and I both believe in Austrian economics, which is the opposite way of approaching things. It's qualitative, not quantitative. Entrepreneurship is human, the entrepreneur, and the creativity and the ideation and the grit to get through the the entrepreneurial phase is all there. So nefarious, we can debate, but elitist, definitely.
Oh, yeah. I like that analysis. We draw blood from the elites here at the show, Hunter. So we'll do that here. You say that, well, I want to maybe just pivot real quick. There has to be administration in this world. Otherwise, things do not get done. But in the book, you do argue that administrative tasks, yes, they need to get done to keep everything moving along. You don't need to be an administrator to do that. And the top-down way of thinking about that, because people are going to, do their accounting, do their all these tasks that are required to keep a business going. But again, you don't need to be top down telling people what to do. Again, humanity is a major part of that.
Yeah. So this is all a big question about systems, Brian. So bureaucracy, which is what administration is, comes from the German tradition. You know, Max Weber and all of that kind of writing about bureaucracy. The German military, where the problem was to get the ideas from the general to executed by the soldier through 27 layers.
And this is the model of traditional schooling also, just from the youngest age up to universities. Okay.
Right. So that control mechanism is well ingrained. You're breaking it down into tasks, which is right. So in order to run my company, I have to do those tasks, mostly given to me by the compliance officer, right? You got to report your accounts every week or every month or whatever it might be. Those tasks can be automated. We don't need the layers of management to say, you must supervise this person to make sure that person supervises that person to get that job done. We don't need those layers. We can automate them. We can just do them. Individuals can do them, and the coordination mechanism can take care of all of the tasks getting done. So, yeah, you can break down a job into services and creativity and tasks and just tell somebody what tasks to do. No, you don't have to do that. The tasks emerge of themselves and they get done.
Okay. And you mentioned Austrian economics earlier. A lot of people know nowadays. It took me until my 30s probably to understand what that was. And I was never introduced to some of the principles, perhaps, but not Austrian economics as a field. When we think of Austrian economics, they're like, is it people from? I don't get it. Is that how Austria runs its economy? No. Like, so give us a little breakdown about Austrian economics and what you've tried to reimagine it. I think for us who did not know is entrepreneurial economics. So give us a little.
I came from the world of branding and my commercial career, and Austrian economics is the worst brand name that's ever been conceived because, as you say, everybody misunderstands it. If you Google it, you usually get Austrian Airlines or something like that. So forget the word Austria. We talked about the logical positivists. There was this whole other school that said, no, it's all about human beings and their creativity and their invention and innovation. And there were three basic elements of Austrian economics, entrepreneurial economics, that we can apply to business and should apply to business. One is what they call in the textbooks customer sovereignty, which means the customer is the boss. That reverses the whole flow of thinking about business. In business, we think we produce things, we market things, we sell things, we get the money, and we go through that cycle again. The opposite is the case. The customer is the boss. What does the customer want? Well, the customer might not be able to articulate that, but they know what they need. And if we can extract that and understand it, we take it backwards through the R&D department, the research department, and then back again through manufacturing and take it back to the customer. So customer sovereignty, brilliant, brilliant insight of an Austrian economist, Ludwig von Mises, but let's not call it that, that drives the corporation in a different direction. The second is entrepreneurship. And Entrepreneurship is the idea of sensing that customers need, turning it into a new idea that's never been done before, and taking that back to market. So entrepreneurship is the implementation of that curve. And then the third element is what I call action over strategy. What is entrepreneurship? Is it great strategic thinking? No, it's action. It is experimentation. So I've listened to the customer. I think I know what they want. I'm not sure. Let me try this. See what they say. They give me some feedback. I come back. I run another experiment. Eventually, that works. Eventually, Brian Chesky's Air Mattress in San Francisco becomes the world's biggest hotel corporation. And so it's action, not strategy. The MBA is all strategy. It's the cornerstone course of, I'm smarter than you. I can figure this out. I can create a strategy that tells me what the future is going to be, and we'll plan our way there. So those three elements of Austrian economics are what I focus on. I mean, there are 12 in the book, but we use those three primarily.
Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah, you have 12 principles of venture mode here. And I guess we have corporate, getting back to the MBA and stuff, there's a lot of corporate jargon. So define for us, for the listeners, what the top three you mentioned, what we can just in plain speak what they are again.
The customer's the boss. The entrepreneur, or I prefer entrepreneurship, is serving that customer, getting them what they want. And you do that through experimental action with a good idea, what we call entrepreneurial intent, and keep experimenting until you get it right. So those are the elements.
And you say everybody does this. This is the way things are done, but it's not really seen by a lot of folks, just in general public. They don't necessarily see this. They're told that it goes the other way. How, Hunter, with venture mode, how are we going to educate the public to have them understand that no, this is actually the way things work in real life, no matter, you know, flip the script again, like you're saying?
Well, we've got to go from generalization to individualization. And one of the stories in the book is about Reed Hastings at Netflix. And if you read, he's a wonderful CEO today, he's not CEO anymore, but the founder of a wonderful corporation. He started because he was pissed off that Blockbuster charged him late fees. And so we call that the atom of value, right? The single interaction that he concentrated on. And I mean, it's a long story, obviously, building the system, but that's where his mindset was. Brian Chesky talks about being in the details, which he means the single customer engaging the single Airbnb host and having an experience. And then you scale that up. You make it work the same for everybody. So we talk about this idea of the atom of value. It's the single interaction. The pivotal interaction in Austrian economics is one customer, one consumer, and one entrepreneur or service provider working in a corporation. And you focus on that level of detail. That's what matters. And then everything scales up from there. There's a fancy term for it, which is complex adaptive systems theory, which is that the interaction of the smallest units is what creates the whole system. And so the essence of what we've got to get people to understand, I think, is going back to that individualization, that atom, and building from there, the reversal of the usual process.
Embrace the unknown. Run toward fear. Know your purpose. Growth mindset. Time isn't your enemy. Avoid comfort. Fortify your resolve.
Subscribe at O'LearyReview.com. Okay. And I see a lot of big companies, they're still stuck in this administration mode, administrative trap, if you will. but they're still doing business, doing great business. We talked about the Fortune 500s and stuff like that. They're still doing things that are making them money. But as you said earlier, maybe there's maybe half of the productivity that was available is just disappeared, essentially, through this mode of administration. So if a lot of our listeners may be budding entrepreneurs themselves and have small businesses and whatnot, how do we as small operators or small businesses, how do we avoid such administrative traps and build our businesses or maybe even our lives in with the idea of venture mode?
Yeah, so two things there, Brian. One, just to take your point about the big corporations, it's highly unlikely they won't be able to escape the administration trap. They're locked in it, they'll die. And you know, we see that a lot in...
But it could be generations down the road, the death, the curse, yeah.
Yes, yeah, it could be the average life of a S&P 500 corporation is about 30, 35 years, I think. So that's the cycle. So then it's better to start off without administration and not fall into it. I'll give you an interesting statistic that we're trying to get more information on. There's a registration classification in China called OPC, One Person Corporations. It's an actual name that they give to the registration of a business. And there are, at middle of 2025, there were 16 million of them in China, just big, big, big number. And the point about these OPCs is they're AI generated. So AI can do a lot of the tasks, as you said, that used to require administration. So you just need that one employee. They're embedded in an ecosystem, a local ecosystem, which is the Chinese industrial complexes that they build around cars and AI and things like that. So you plug into that ecosystem, so you have tons and tons of resources to draw on, and then the bigger ecosystem of the Chinese export machine. So there's still one person corporations, but you never need to administer them. You can partner in them. You can AI-ify them, you can build them with e-commerce without ever having to bring that administration in. So I think it'll start from scratch. If you look at business registrations in the US, you see the same phenomenon, a much greater degree of business formation now than ever before. And about 3/4 of them, I think, are solo entrepreneurs. The others are groups, and there's nothing wrong with obviously a team formation. But I think what'll happen is we'll start there and we won't let administration come in. So if you're always thinking of the details, ever see any barrier between that one service provider and that one customer, get rid of it. And again, that's flow theory, removing the barriers so it flows freely.
Okay. And in Austrian economics, we analyze what's happening. It's to predict the future. You know, like, of course, all the things that have happened in the economy since 2008, a lot of people are like, oh, it's going to crash. It hasn't crashed. The bulls are there, like, it should have crashed, right? But so the timeline for all this happening, I don't think you can say, oh, it's going to happen next year or it's going to happen in a generation from now. But we're trending that way, I think, because of you and a lot of economists and entrepreneurs are showing us that a different approach works. And then you talk a lot about the NBA is dead. It's dying. It's not quite dead yet. They're getting a lot of people still going to school to get their MBA. But you have had this idea for a number of years now to replace the MBA with a different type of advanced degree, and even going so far as to get business school ideas going. We don't need to get into that necessarily, but you call this the Masters of Business business enterprise or business entrepreneurship. Well, you know, probably interchangeably, but in the book you call it business enterprise. What's that look like in practice versus the traditional MBA that you can get at any number of universities?
Yes, I think firstly, you shouldn't get your business education from a university. They are not geared towards...
Speaking of a couple of university educated folks.
That's right. I didn't get any business education at university. I got economics, which is a different thing altogether. But we break the business education into two components. One is learn these principles, learn the principles of venture mode, learn the principles of value creation, learn the principles of customer first, understand how systems work, understand innovation, those kinds of things. Those are principles, and principles scale. Details don't, administration doesn't, principles scale. You can learn them, they're good for life. And we could teach that online, we could teach it in various formats that aren't university. That's one half. The second half is experiential. It's active learning through experience. So we would do that through training inside the corporation, where the corporation takes in, let's call it an apprentice or an intern, puts them on a real team with real problems to solve, with real resource allocation issues and problems that have to be solved by a certain time frame, you know, like real life. And they'll learn from their teammates, they'll learn from the corporation, and there'll be a job for them at the end of it or not, depending on how they perform. And, you know, that's not entirely revolutionary. It's just we should take it out of the university. So I saw that Meta this morning talks about creating, I can't remember the title of it, some kind of academy for American workers. And it's not actually aimed at so much what we call white collar work, but the kind of work of the electricians and construction and so on like that, because they're thinking of the data centers. Google has a lot of certifications about how to learn to use their stuff. And then, you know, back in my days when I went to Procter & Gamble as my first job, they taught me business. I didn't learn it in the university. So there's two ideas. Learn the principles, the best principles, not administration, and then go get experience, because experience compounds and you get better and better.
Mm-hmm. And this dovetails a bit into another concept you talk about, not necessarily in this book. You've written about it before, and I think you got a book coming out. We'll see in a number of months, talking about enablement. You talk about this concept called enablement, which, you know, again, you're not going to necessarily find a whole exposition in this book, but go to, we'll get you Hunter's links here in a second, but this idea of enablement, can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah. So it's a thinking about, we always have this discussion about who creates value. And in Austrian economics, the customer is a creator of value. But firms don't understand that. They think they're the author of value and that the customer is the recipient of value. So to get beyond that and get firms to understand that is to think about enabling the customer so that they have new capacity to go create more value themselves. And I think AI is a good version of this. If I now have access to greater intelligence than I had before, more knowledge, and I can go apply that. Anthropic is not telling me how to do that. They're just saying, hey, here's this enablement, go create some new value. Coding is a great example of that. Right now, everybody can code. So we've enabled a whole new generation to create new things. And what I'm trying to do is think about a systematization of that, where we're all entrepreneurially enabled. We're all going to be these one-person companies. Our compensation is not going to be job-based compensation with a wage and benefits package. It's going to be ownership compensation. It's going to be equity compensation. The whole incentives in the economy change for the better. Everyone's a value creator, and they've got to succeed in order to be compensated, just like an entrepreneur. So I'm working on a systematization of that. I call it the enablement economy. And as you say, wait for the book in 2027.
Okay, 2027, yeah. And you mentioned AI, and we got a few more minutes here. And we talk about AI every week, or like a little bit about what's going on. And my contention is, like you mentioned a little bit, the enablement of the individual using the AI, various different things, and it's ubiquitous now. But my contention is that, at least for me, the speed in which we can do certain tasks, administrative tasks, the blowing up the administration mode is remarkable. And it allows, and we talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago, I think, too, about how, you know, say 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you mentioned coding. The whole thing was like, oh, you don't need to go to college, just go take a coding class and you can get a job as a coder. Well, you can, but everybody, like you can say, everybody can code now if by just using this. So what does it do? It allows you to use more of your mind, your intellect, to do higher level things as opposed to these, say, administrative tasks, which again have to be done, but they can be done with such speed and without, you know, tremendous amounts of screwing up, because people screw up all the time too. AI is going to screw up, but the speed in which we can accomplish tasks, create ideas, create offers, those are all things with AI. Just in general speak of artificial intelligence that we're able to do now. Further comments there, or am I on the right track?
Yeah, I think speed is one of the essential components of what AI is enabling. And again, go back to administration. It's the 5-year plan. It's the 1-year budget cycle. It's the 90-day review. And we have a mental model of speed that is plodding, and we've got to change that mental model. We've got to get into almost real-time adaptation and making changes. So Elon Musk talks about, at a Tesla factory, real-time reallocation of resources. I'm not 100% sure how that works, but everyone's connected to the data. And if you find you need to make a change on the production line and it's going to take some resources to get it, you just click and get the resources. And the system figures out the reallocation. So everything we've thought about planning, budgeting, resource allocation, administration changes. Speed takes over. Now, you got to reduce the error rate. And they talk about hallucination in AI, and it's got a 20 to 30% false positives rate in some areas of application. So we've got to solve that problem.
It's been getting better, but still, like when you're talking 20%, that means 20%, it means like it's only 80% true, which, you know, Pareto principle, maybe that applies, but like, come on, we're trying to be correct. We're trying to be right. And that 20% gap is pretty huge.
But it'll go away. You know, we'll get to 5.9s at some point in time. And so this idea of speed, how fast can things move? How fast can things change? How fast can tomorrow come and then the week after tomorrow? So I think that's one of the things that we have to change our mental model. And one way to capture that is adaptation. Always looking for the change, always adapting to it. It's responsiveness to the system. Sometimes you can throw new ideas into the system. It's going to tell you pretty quickly back whether it works or not. So that's the experimentation I talked about. But never lock yourself into something that takes too much time, because you've got to cycle faster and faster, which is great. More progress in less time.
Yeah, I call myself a short-term pessimist, long-term optimist. And I think when you look at it, economics, business, entrepreneurship, within this framework, I think the optimism is there. Because you can pick apart all sorts of problems with what's going on today, and it's not going to change, but it will. It does. And I think, you know, not only in business and entrepreneurship, the study of economics, in the short term, yeah, we might be stuck. You know, there's companies stuck in administrative mode. They're, like you said, they're never going to get out of it. They'll die. But long term, for the health of society and civilization, I think we're moving in the right direction. So that I'm optimistic, Hunter. And I think that you've designed a way of thinking, really, that is fairly unique, drawing from Austrian economics and business application and all that stuff to get here to venture mode.
Well, good. Well, thank you. I'll sign off one note on your short-term pessimism. That's Austrian economics. Ludwig von Mises said, unease, which is I'm unhappy with the current situation, I want it to be better. That's the driver of improvement, of innovation. If we weren't uneasy, if we weren't short-term pessimists, we'd never fix it and get to the future. So that's one of the principles of Austrian economics. Everyone's uneasy, and we're all working to improve the future. So remember the long-term optimism. That's the key thing, but you can be a short-term pessimist.
There you go. Well, it's been a great conversation, Hunter. Where you can get a free chapter of Venture Mode. Where can they go to get that?
There's a site for the book called venturemode.biz. Very fashionable, right? And there's a free chapter there, and you can order the book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or a number of other places straight from the site. And then on Substack, if you want to go and find my articles on the enablement economy, it's The Value Creators.
The Value Creators at Substack. And we'll have all that stuff in the show notes. Once again, Hunter Hastings, Venture Mode. He is with The Value Creators, but Venture Mode came out May 5th, and we wish you the best of luck, Hunter, with the book and the future.
Good. I'm a big believer in the future.
All right. Well, take care, Hunter. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Brian D. O'Leary Show with author and economist Hunter Hastings. If you're ready to escape the administration trap and embrace venture mode, the work is just the beginning. To keep challenging the elitist top-down systems and exploring the true potential of entrepreneurial economics, you need to stay in the loop. Head over to O'LearyReview.com right now and subscribe to Unrelenting. Remember, short-term unease is the driver of long-term optimism and innovation. Visit O'LearyReview.com and subscribe today.